Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
This is it, the 10th and final part of our audio series exploring the, well, the really complex history of Afrin.
That's right. Wrapping it up.
And today we're zeroing in on a particularly challenging time, the era of Ba'ath rule in Syria. Specifically, we're looking at 1963 right up to 2009.
A long and very significant period.
Our mission here, and we're sticking purely to the materials you've shared with us, is to understand the state policies, you know, the ones designed to marginalize Kurds and deny their identity during these decades.
And not just the policies, but how they actually impacted the community in Afrin.
Exactly. And crucially, how people there navigated that reality, lived through it.
Yeah, because understanding this period, these pressures and dynamics before 2009, is absolutely critical for grasping everything that follows. It really sets the stage.
Okay, let's get into it. The core principle of Ba'athist rule, as the sources describe it, it was this intense Arab nationalism, wasn't it? Aimed at unifying the nation under that banner.
Precisely. And the sources show that this ideology, it often translated directly into discriminatory practices against non-Arab minorities, Kurds included, of course.
So not just an abstract idea. It had real teeth.
Oh, absolutely. Direct consequences for Kurdish identity.
So what specific policies do the sources highlight? How did they try to suppress that identity?
Well, the materials detail pretty explicit attempts to suppress the Kurdish language, Kurdish culture.
Well,
just push it out of public life.
And citizenship denial, too. That comes up in the sources.
It does. A major tool used against Kurds. But, interestingly, the sources make a distinction for Afrin.
Oh, how so?
They note that while citizenship denial is a huge issue, especially over in the Jazeera region, it was apparently less widespread, maybe less aggressively pushed in Afrin during this specific time frame.
Why was that, according to the sources? What made Afrin different in that respect?
It seems to boil down, at least partly, to Afrin's demographic history. The sources point to this long-standing, relatively continuous Kurdish presence there.
So, a different kind of social landscape compared to Jazeera. Jazeera had more recent migrations shaping its Kurdish population in the 20th century, right?
Exactly. Afrin seems to have had this greater demographic homogeneity pre-2010, which created a different dynamic with the state on that specific issue.
Okay. So beyond language and citizenship, the state also used demographic engineering strategies, Arabization programs.
Yes, the sources talk about those quite a bit. These were aimed pretty clearly at diluting the Kurdish presence, especially in border zones considered strategic, like Afrin.
But again, the Afrin difference.
Right. The sources reiterate that Afrin seems to have experienced less direct state-sponsored Arabization compared to Jazeera. Again, it seems a distinct demographic history offered some kind of buffer.
Made those direct resettlement tactics less impactful there.
That seems to be the picture the sources paint. It shows how local context could really shape how these broader state policies actually played out on the ground.
Fascinating. Now, the state's intervention wasn't just about identity, was it? They also exerted a lot of control over land and the economy. How did that work?
Land reform is a big one mentioned in the sources. Agricultural reform laws. These started even before the Ba'ath fully consolidated power in 63, back in the late 50s, and they continued under the Ba'ath.
And the goal was?
Primarily, to break the power of the big landowners.
Which in Afrin meant the Kurdish agas, the traditional elites.
Exactly. The state set ceilings on how much land one person could own, and then redistributed the land they took over.
What was the effect of that, based on the sources?
It struck right at the economic heart of those aga families. Their economic dominance was seriously undercut. The sources suggest this really sped up the decline of that old feudal system and triggered some pretty big social changes in Afrin.
And the land laws weren't just about reform, were they? The sources didn't talk about them being used as instruments of control more broadly.
Absolutely. It went beyond just breaking up big estates.
Mm-hmm.
Specific laws like Decree 49, which the sources highlight.
Decree 49, what did that do?
Essentially, it created massive bureaucratic headaches for anyone trying to register or prove ownership of land, especially in border areas. And Afrin is a border area.
So it made it incredibly difficult to hold on to land you already had or even secure new claims.
Precisely. It created this deep insecurity around land ownership. And for a rural community, land is everything.
Yeah.
The sources indicate this made farming much more difficult, more precarious, and it was one of the pressures pushing Kurds out of rural areas even before 2010. It was economic pressure applied through legal means.
Right. Okay, let's shift just a bit. What about Afrin's economy itself during this time? What was its backbone, according to the sources?
Olives. The sources are crystal clear on that. Olive cultivation was paramount. Afrin's landscape, its economy, even its identity were all tied up with olive trees and olive oil.
And wheat production, too. The sources mention that increasing, especially as you get closer to 2010.
That's right. It's useful to contrast that, as the sources do, with other Kurdish areas. Like Jazeera, again, much more focused on big grain farms, cotton, and critically oil. Syria's oil reserves are mostly there.
So Afrin had this very distinct, almost olive-focused agricultural base.
Very much so. And another key economic point from the sources, the connection to Aleppo.
Ah, yes, the big city nearby.
Absolutely vital. Aleppo was Syria's northern economic engine, and the sources describe Afrin as its crucial agricultural hinterland, supplying olives, oil, other produce to that huge urban market.
And this wasn't just trade, was it? The sources mentioned deeper links.
Yeah, really interesting. It was reinforced by social networks, even religious ones. Sufi networks are mentioned, connecting rural Afrin directly to urban Aleppo. It shows a really tight rural-urban relationship.
We should also touch on environmental factors. The sources mention Syria facing droughts before 2010.
They do. And that government responses elsewhere were often seen as inadequate, leading to people being displaced internally.
How did that affect Afrin?
Well, Afrin relied on rain-fed agriculture mostly, so it was vulnerable too. The sources suggest droughts could have limited Afrin's ability to take in displaced people.
Or even caused people from Afrin to leave during dry spells.
Potentially, yes. Though the sources aren't super specific about Afrin being a major destination for those particular pre-2010 drought migrants, that part's a bit less clear in the material we have.
Okay. So despite all these pressures, state policies, land issues, economic vulnerability, the community in Afrin showed resilience, didn't they? How did they cope, according to the sources?
A lot of it seems tied to the sociocultural fabric described in the sources. That relative demographic homogeneity we talked about earlier compared to Jazeera is mentioned, and also Afrin's distinct religious landscape.
What was distinct about it?
The sources really highlight the significant historical presence and, importantly, the integration of Yazidi and Alevi minorities living alongside the Sunni Muslim majority.
Fostering more internal diversity and maybe tolerance.
That's the picture the sources paint, yes. A climate of relative religious diversity within Afrin.
And they give specific examples.
They do. Certain villages known for their Yazidi populations, Kimar, Barad, Burj Abdalo, Gazawiya, Iska, are named. And the Mabatli sub-district is pointed out as the main center for Alevi Kurds, so it wasn't monolithic.
So given the state repression, how did people hang on to their identity, keep community structures going? The sources link this back to that demographic stability.
It seems so. The idea presented is that this stability might have helped reinforce internal community bonds, making certain strategies possible.
Like dissimulation, the sources use that term. What does that actually mean?
It's basically appearing to conform outwardly. Playing along, you could say, to avoid attracting the full force of state repression.
But underneath?
Underneath, quietly maintaining collective awareness, cultural practices, social ties, keeping the identity alive in less visible ways. A kind of subtle, everyday resistance described in the materials.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosh Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Whoa. Let's see what she's brought today.
Smells good. How's yours? Needs a bit of sugar, I think. Mine's a touch bitter today.
Mine's all right, actually. Maybe just a splash more. Okay. All right, back to it. So this dissimulation was a key strategy.
It seems to have been. But what's also important, and the sources make this clear, is that it wasn't the only response. There were still moments of open confrontation.
Right. It wasn't all quiet resistance, sporadic protests, clashes.
Yes. The sources give examples. Demonstrations during Nowruz, the Kurdish New Year in Afrin, back in March 1986, those apparently resulted in casualties.
And then the Komishli uprising in 2004, that was a bigger event.
Much bigger. The sources show that starting in Komishli, it spread fast to other Kurdish towns, even reaching Kurdish neighborhoods in Aleppo and Damascus.
A real challenge to the Ba'ath regime under Bashar al-Assad.
Definitely a significant challenge, though, as the sources note, the regime cracked down hard.
Violently suppressed.
Yes, with lethal force reported. And this happened, the sources point out, even though Bashar al-Assad had made some early sort of gestures towards reform after he took power in 2000. Gestures that hadn't amounted to much for Kurds by 2004?
Apparently not, based on the sources.
Yeah.
Very little substantive change.
Okay. And just briefly, what about the Kurdish political scene itself in Syria before 2010? What do the sources say?
They describe it as pretty fragmented. multiple parties, many forced to operate underground because the Ba'ath suppressed any open Kurdish political activity.
Parties like?
KDPS, KDPP, Yekiti, Azadi are some names mentioned in the materials. Despite being illegal and fragmented, the sources suggest they were trying to represent Kurdish aspirations, maintain networks, keep some political structure alive.
Okay, so we've covered a lot. The state policies, the economic situation, the land issues, Afrin's specific context, and how the community responded, both subtly and sometimes openly, all leading up to 2009. Let's bring this back to you, our listener. Why is digging into this specific period, 1963 to 2009, in Afrin, so important?
Well, if you want to understand the deeper history, you really have to grasp these dynamics. The state's efforts at marginalization, the specific ways they controlled land and tried to shape identity.
And Afrin's unique experience within that, its demographics, its economy, that Aleppo connection.
Exactly. And the community's own strategies for survival and resistance. Understanding all of that provides the essential foundation. It's the backdrop against which everything after 2009 has to be understood. It sets that historical stage.
So to quickly recap this final part of our look at Afrin's history up to 2009, we've examined Ba'athist marginalization, the targeting of identity, the control over land. We've seen Afrin's distinct path shaped by its people, its olives, its link to Aleppo.
And we've highlighted the community's resilience, the dissimulation, maintaining internal structures, but also those moments of open defiance.
Right. And this history, as laid out in the sources, leaves us with a question, doesn't it? Something for you to think about.
Definitely. Considering those relentless state policies trying to erase Kurdish identity and the community's determined strategies to hold on to it, both subtly and through maintaining their own structures, what does this specific history really tell us about the sheer strength, the endurance of cultural identity under that kind of intense pressure?
And maybe, how do those pre-2010 dynamics, the state's actions, the community's responses, how do they shape the context, the lens through which we need to understand everything that unfolded later? Food for thought.
Indeed.
Well, thank you for joining us throughout this 10-part audio series on the history of Afrin.